welcome to the Heritage Langham podcast number 10, Double Figures. I'm Heather Payton. This month, what's really underneath the St. Jerome's effigies? We use 21st century technology to find out and discover what keeps one man awake at night.
This is very stressful. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't.
Has that ever happened?
No, fortunately, and I don't want it to.
And we discover new fruit on the complicated Flemish family tree.
Finding out who the effigy really was, that was brilliant. And also then, by a matter of deduction, we could work out who the lady was.
Back in April, we were told by medieval historian Dr. Rhiannath Bibrac about a case in Herefordshire in which an effigy of a woman, about the same age as the effigies in St. Jerome's, was removed from its plinth and tomb chest for conservation. And much to everyone's surprise, there was the lady herself in a lead-lined coffin inside. So what would we find underneath our effigies, also due to be moved for protection from the damp? We already know who the effigies commemorate, Sir Robert de la Roche and his grandmother Margaret. More on that later. Anyway, by mid-August, the delicate task of sliding a damp-proof membrane between the effigies and their plinths had already been carried out, but we still didn't know what was underneath the plinth. We had permission to investigate, drilling holes and using an endoscope, the type of instrument used for medical purposes and for inspecting drains. So one day we all gathered in the church, complete with cameras and recording equipment, and of course, the endoscope. Well, we're in St. Jerome's. The effigies have been lifted and they've been protected from damp and replaced. And this is the day when we hope to see what's inside the chest underneath them. Now with me is stonemason Andrew Gibson, who performed the tricky task of lifting these huge pieces of stone. Andrew, tell me about that.
So what we did is we cleaned out the joints around the edges of the effigy. So we slip in what we call lifting slings, which are like sort of very strong tapes, quite thin, that we slide underneath it, and they've got eyes on the end, and they hook, you hook them onto a lifting hoist.
How scary is that? Because you have awful nightmares. You must have awful nightmares about the whole thing breaking.
Yes, it's very stressful. I'd be lying if I said it was.
Has that ever happened?
No, fortunately, and I don't want it to. No.
How much do you think they weigh?
I would think our friend on the right is probably getting on for about 200 kilos.
So. And that's the male?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And, okay, so you lift them. How far up do you lift them?
Initially, we just lift them between half an inch to an inch so that we can get some wood chocks, some skids that we can slide underneath the effigies so we can reposition our lifting slings in a better position, because it's about weight distribution and putting excess strain and stress on the stone so it doesn't break.
Yeah. And what do you do then?
So then we winched him as far, basically as high as we could possibly lift him, in order to fit the lead underneath then, lay the lead flat. And then we load him back down into place then. So
you've lifted him and her as well. And what's the stuff you put between?
Well, the grounds underneath where the lead sits was a little bit sort of broken up and very loose. So we've cleaned the loose stuff out of the way, and we've put a new bed of lime mortar, so it's nice and flat. And then we can lay the lead out on that, so it's got a nice flat surface. And we've lowered him back into place then.
So you've got, you can actually see it, there's a little bit sticking out. You've got a sheet of lead, and this will stop rising damp.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So all we need left to do now is just to trim around the edges so that it's a neat edge around the edge of the effigy.
So what happens now? You've got to trim around the edges, and this chap and his the other one we think is his grandmother, by the way. They're going to be all right for now on, for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, well, I think they'll probably outlast me.
Well, the drill is going in now, and the endoscope will go through that. How far did you have to go in?
We've gone in about 400 mil.
Which is quite a fair distance. It's very thick, isn't it? So you've drilled it in the...
About halfway under the effigy by now.
And so that you've drilled that in the wall of the tomb chest. So now Neil, who's the owner of the endoscope,
normally used for musical instruments, is going to pop it in and we're going to see what we can find in there. The endoscope is basically a camera on...
A camera on a cable,
thank you, yeah. With a light on it, and that's connected to a laptop.
Yeah, and on the laptop you can see the screen. The biggest problem with it is knowing which way is up.
It's once it's inside the tomb chest.
Even when it's out of the tomb chest.
And that's because the thing is round, the camera with the light on it is round, and so it's almost impossible to tell, isn't it?
It is, so you take your best guess.
It's going to go in now, isn't it?
That's the idea. Let's just hope the hole is big enough. And remember, what you're seeing is very, very small. No, I can't get any further. There's a blockage. Okay. And I'll get the dirt off the end of the camera.
So we've opened the hole a bit with the drill bit again, so having another go.
Yeah, that was mainly to try and clear some of the debris. You can see the hole a bit more clearly now. Mm. And there's a cavity. So that's loose rubble. There's a lot of dirt and dust in there, obviously. It's been there for a while.
So we might be looking at 600-year-old dirt and dust.
I think that's exactly what we're looking at. Right, there's no sign of anything else except rubble in this hole. Mm. It might be worth one or two other approaches, because there are some holes lower down.
All right.
Possible to go in lower down?
So fast forward a short time, and we've now drilled two holes. A few problems, Neil, aren't there?
We don't even know if there's anything down there. And the endoscopes aren't the easiest of things to use.
Well, you keep getting blocked, or the endoscope keeps getting blocked by bits and pieces that have presumably accumulated over 600 years. But you have actually managed to get it in. What do you reckon?
I reckon that there's nothing under here. Mm. It looks as if it's rubble. It's rubble and dirt and just things to fill in the hole to take the weight of the effigy and to stop this from collapsing in on itself. There's absolutely no sign of anything else left behind.
And if there'd been a lead-lined casket, as there was with the case in Herefordshire, I think we would have found that, wouldn't we?
Possibly. It all depends. I mean, we've gone in a very small area. Mm. Unless you're willing to have holes drilled down the length of the effigy and the height of the plinth, then we might have missed it. Because I'm only looking at perhaps an area of 100 millimetre width.
Bit disappointing.
Not surprising.
Oh, well, Neil Martin delivering the bad news. So if there is anyone in there, we'll let them sleep on in peace. We met two of the descendants of Langham's Flemish founders in effigy form there in St. Jerome's, Robert Delaroche and his granny Margaret. Robert, of course, was a direct descendant of the 11th century patriarch Godbert the Fleming, or Godbertus Flandrensis, as the Latin texts would have him. The reason we know that is down to our research supremo Liz Rawlings, along with our tame medieval historian Dr. Rhiannath Bibrac, an extraordinary achievement after so long. If you heard Liz at our Meet the Experts event back in July, you'll already know a fair bit about the progress she's made on the family tree of the Delaroches, and now she's found out some more. I joined her as she explained her results. So Liz, we're in your kitchen. And you have covered your kitchen table with pieces of paper. What are they? A3s all stuck together with sticky tape. Yeah. And we've got the family history going down from Godebert right down to... Now, what's the latest one you've got there?
This is about 1530.
So that's a lot of generations.
Yeah, I think we're down to 12 now.
What I found was completely new and really interesting is that you know who Godebert married.
Yes, I did find it's only one reference in an old document to Adeline de Speck, and she was a Norman, and I know who her parents were. She's the only one that I found so far.
And we still don't really know anything about Godibert's background, do we?
Godibert himself, we don't know whose father is, but I have found two other references in 1057 and in 1063 in Provost. And the first one is Godibertus was named as a clericus, as a clerk, so he could have been a cleric or a clerk, but of course they were allowed to marry if he was a clerk.
And those dates are before Godibert was born. He was born in 1096, I think, wasn't he?
Yes, and this would have been before the conquest. Mm. So whether or not this was his grandfather, great-grandfather, we don't know. I'm just going simply by the name.
And Godibert and Adeline, we're assuming it's Adeline, they had two sons. They had Richard and Rodibert, and these were the two that went off to Ireland as part of the expeditionary force. Richard's on a separate page, so we're going to have to talk about him later.
What you see in front of you is just Rodbert's family tree. And that's complicated enough without trying to put Richard on the same page. So, yeah, Richard's on a separate sheet.
So after Rodibert, you've got Rodibert had Adam, Henry and David. If we look at Adam, who married someone called Blandane, wonderful, wonderful name, now, he's the one that seems to lead to most of the results you've got.
Yes. Although he wasn't particularly prolific as a father, he just had David as his son. Then that trail comes actually down through to the Pembrokeshire side quite clearly. Mm. And his line comes down through Sir David de la Roche, who marries Lady Joanna.
Yes.
And then, obviously, their son is Robert, who is the effigy we have in the church.
Okay, so let's look at him and what happened to him. Okay, there he is. He's Robert, and he's got what are the blue crosses alongside him?
Just so that I remember which Robert is actually the effigy, because this is quite complicated and confusing, as you can see. Yeah,
he had John, who married Isabella.
He married into quite a wealthy family. So, yes, he moved away and, he set up another estate, actually.
The one I'm particularly interested in is Sir Roger de Clarendon. And the reason for that is that he figures very largely in the tapestry. And we've actually got one of the images of him being hanged, which is pretty horrible because he'd got on the wrong side of the king and got things totally wrong. And his wife was Margaret, who was, as far as we can tell, the last in the obvious line of the De La Roches. And it came to an end after them, didn't it?
Well, their branch did. Mm, but obviously yes. there was a cousin. There were people inherited her estate because she was not of age. And therefore, her husband, Roger de Clarendon, didn't inherit anything apart from this silk bed that was left to them by the Black Prince. But her four cousins inherited, and there were lawsuits and court cases for the next 20 years about her vast estates.
You also, of course, came up with all these branches of the family that might not be direct from the ones we're talking about, from Margaret, but they're all over Britain, aren't they?
Yes, they married into various families throughout Britain and certainly got six strands of the family. Obviously Pembrokeshire and Ireland, they're the two that we know most about, but we've also got Cornwall, Devon, Wiltshire and the Isle of Wight.
And are they mostly descended from female lines, so they wouldn't be called Roche?
Yes.
And we haven't talked about Richard. Now, what is there of interest to say about him? And Richard, of course, is the other son of Godibert.
I think both the sons must have been quite brutal, quite warlike, because they certainly went. I mean, Richard went out on a pre-expeditionary force before Strongbow. So Richard was a go-getter. Rodbert went with him and Strongbow on the first exhibition, and obviously that meant that they were granted vast areas of lands and what have you. So Richard actually had his oldest son was called Rodbert after his brother. Managed to find one daughter, and daughters are very difficult to find at this time unless they marry into some family which are incredibly wealthy. And her dad actually gave her an estate that he'd already owned down in Cornwall.
Liz, how do you do all this? I mean, what sort of documents do you look at and how do you get at them?
Most of this is done online now. Luckily, I mean, if this was 10 years ago, I wouldn't be able to research the way that we are. But things are coming online all the time. You know, I've got access to the National Library of Wales. I've got access to various other places like the British Museum. And you can actually, once you become a member, you can join in. And then, of course, there are lots of websites. I try not to use genealogical websites because obviously... sometimes they don't include source material, and I like to go from primary sources whenever possible. So it does give a validity then to your investigations. Some collections, if they're very valuable and fragile, you have to go. For example, I'm going up to the National Library tomorrow, so I'll be having a look at some of the estate documents up there to see if I can find a little bit more information out. But also, sometimes you have to bite the bullet and go.
Looking at all of this, and there's just so many names, what's the one, the discovery that you've been most chuffed about?
Oh, I think finding the effigy. Finding out who the effigy really was. I think that was brilliant, and it was great because Dr. Rhiannydd Breabach, who was doing some work on the effigies for us, she actually found out who he was at almost exactly the same time as I did, and we just conferred, and it was lovely because obviously I had ratification, but so did she, because we found it in different sources. And that was brilliant. So I think that was the amazing bit. And also then, by a matter of deduction, we could work out who the lady was, who we believe was his grandmother.
Liz Rawlings unravelling the complicated history of the Della Roach family. And Liz mentioned Sir David and Lady Joanna, parents of Robert, the man in the effigy. Well, as you may know, it's David and Joanna's wedding we're celebrating in style, both on the tapestry and at Heritage Langham's medieval weekend next spring. That's it for this month. As ever, thanks to our friends at the Heritage Lottery Fund for making our project possible, and thanks to you for listening.